Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Unauthorized Disclosure Podcast. I'm Kevin Gastola, and I'm joined by Rania Kalik. Hey, Rania.
Hey, Kevin.
We're excited to be here to do another show, and we wanted to start by reading a comment we received. This was related to an episode that we did for patrons only. If you want to listen to it, it was Rania talking about her trip to Moscow and what it was like to be in Russia. And so in reaction, we got this comment from Jed, who was speaking to something you were saying about what it was like to be there. So he said, I minored in Russian in college and lived in St. Petersburg for a month in 2005. It was in the summer, too. No coincidence that the trip was planned during the White Nights. I grew up in the upper Midwest, though, so cold weather is nothing new to me. I used to be semi-fluent in Russian. Russians were so forgiving, though. In my experience, many knew at least a little English. Even just trying to get through a few sentences in Russian was usually enough. Mostly, they were flattered a Westerner even bothered to try. They knew instantly my thick accent made me sound like John Wayne trying to speak it, but the attempt went a long way. The whole experience really fucked me up. I just felt lied to the entire time. I haven't been the same since. I had a similar experience. I was bothered more by how similar it was rather than different. If Russia was authoritarian, the U.S. very clearly was too. On a day-to-day level, you could hardly tell the difference. I also stayed in a Soviet-era apartment building with a host family. It wasn't that bad. I stayed in way shittier places than that in New York, by far. It was a pivotal event of my youth. I had a moment where it dawned on me we had almost gone to war with these people. It made me nauseous. It's something I've never gotten over even today.
Yeah, no, I can totally relate to that. Obviously, I don't speak any Russian, but I can totally relate to that. It's like, this is just like everywhere else. I don't feel like I'm in some like dictatorship. And it's also like a lovely place. And it sounds so silly to like say that. It's like, oh, they're humans too. But like, at the same time, when a country and a people are so are constantly demonized, it does make you angry and outraged when you go to a place and you're just like, wow, you're really giving these people a bad rep, like just for bullshit pro-war reasons. So yeah, thanks for that comment and feedback.
I really
appreciate it.
I really appreciate the line about you know, if we're so similar and then Russia's authoritarian, then you know, don't we have to view the United States similarly? And there was a report that was going around in mainstream news or you know, it's popping up more because it's related to the World Cup and how people are covering this mass sporting event. And all of these sports journalists always want to fold in a flavor of what it's like in the country. And I think this was on like the Fox Sports Network. And, you know, typically they don't do political news, but they can't help themselves. So they say that Putin will soon have, you know, nobody around him that dissents. He'll have nobody who will challenge him because, you know, of all this different power grabbing that he's engaged in. And I just, you know, I can't help but think the way I follow Trump that like, oh, you know, you could say the same, like at some point, like, or actually probably already, like there's nobody around Trump that can challenge him. Like he's not going to allow that to happen. So doesn't that suggest authoritarianism?
Yeah, we don't cover the U.S. in the same way, of course. The U.S. has held a different standards. And also, like, domestic politics of a country are domestic politics of the country. And that doesn't mean that, like, it impacts, like, every aspect of the country. That's just the local domestic politics. And, I mean, like, there are countries, like, Russia does have, like, repressive, like, politically can be repressive. No one's like denying that, but so can a lot of other countries, just like the U.S. can as well in different ways. And just like a lot of U.S. allies can be that are even way far more repressive. So it's just kind of like disingenuous when like these media outlets act like they care about this, because like there are far worse countries that are America's best friends. And that's why I just don't take any of that crap seriously.
So thanks, Jed. And now we'll move on. I want to quickly update on reality winners case for those of you listening to the show, especially if you're interested in hearing this. You know, this flew under the radar, I'd say, in the past week, and understandably so, and we'll maybe get to it a little bit in more detail, but this she pled guilty at the same time that you had the Supreme Court affirming the Muslim ban. So that really overshadowed, I think, what you know, we could have had a day where this became something that more people, especially who follow news on Twitter or Facebook, might have been more interested in reports of the day. But obviously, and I think understandably, the fact that a Muslim ban is going to be able to stand under Donald Trump and that Trump basically got a victory from the Supreme Court, that was more significant. So, you know, for people who didn't hear, reality is pled guilty, and the big news was that she's probably going to get a sentence of 5 years and 3 months, which is a lot. It's actually longer than other cases that have been mentioned on this show involving alleged leaks or involving whistleblowing. And she's suffering from depression, and she had to tell the judge that she was suffering from an eating disorder. These things, just because they judge your mental competency when you're changing your plea. So, and I was struck by that just because it suggested to me that this could be the toll that the U.S. prosecution has taken on her, because extraordinarily, she's been kept in jail. And usually in these kinds of cases, I mean, it's not a violent offense to leak information. And so people, especially not military, but just federal government employees, they aren't kept in jail before they go through these proceedings, before they go to trial. There was a CIA whistleblower, Jeffrey Sterling, and there's John Kiriakou, and they were never imprisoned at all before they were found guilty or took plea agreements. So, and this is on the upper end of the scale as far as like what kind of a sentence she could have gotten. And the max, if she had gone to trial, was she would get 10 years in prison under the Espionage Act. And apparently the prosecutors were pushing for just that much and believed that they could get it with her. And it's only one count. And I think what's really staggering is how it's only one count. And Jeffrey Sterling was convicted of violating the Espionage Act and of 7 counts of this, and only got 42 months in prison as a sentence. And she's got 1 count that she's pleading guilty to and will likely get a sentence of 5 years or 60 plus months. And so that to me just shows just how, again, we've talked about the theme on this show. Of how, like, Obama lays this foundation with the deportation machine, Trump escalates it. Obama laid this foundation to make it really easy to prosecute leakers or whistleblowers, and now Trump is pumping it into overdrive with the support of, you know, like, see as like a impish, kind of elfish Jeff Sessions, who is just eager and excited to go after people who leak and wants nothing more than to put someone like reality behind bars.
Damn.
So
I'm glad that they're covering it though, because like, I think I really didn't, it wasn't, I don't think it would have been that much different. The fact that it didn't get that much attention, whether the Supreme Court decision happened or not. This case in general has kind of ever, when it first happened, it got a lot of attention, but ever since then, it's been pretty much like you and The Intercept,
So this was the first time that The Intercept sent a person, except for maybe when she first appeared in court and was arraigned. And, you know, if I'm wrong, let me know. But I was there for the Miranda hearing that involved whether FBI agents had violated her rights when they interrogated her in her home as she was raided in June 2017. And they weren't there to cover that day of proceedings, but they did send somebody, and there was a lot more press that at this proceeding than there was for the Miranda hearing with the FBI. And so I do think that, like, it got more play. It's getting more play. People are going to pay attention maybe slightly more, but it's resolved. Like, the whole thing is over. The opportunity to inform and possibly build up some pressure that would make the defense feel like taking this on has passed. And so they've given up because there's no way that they can go into a courtroom and argue a defense. The prosecutors have so much power to shut them down. You know, it's not the only criminal offense where the prosecutors have this kind of power. There's other situations where the prosecutors are able to basically strong arm the defense and force them into wanting to take a plea so that they just get this over with, and there's no risk of having an extraordinarily a much longer sentence. But it's just like, you know, they wanted to fight this, and it would be good to fight this, because I think the thing that I'll say, and maybe we'll come back to this after we hear the sentence, but for right now, what I would leave people with is, it's the Espionage Act. It's this law from 1917. It was actually used to go after people who were fighting military recruitment and were anti-war protesters. It was used against socialists. It was used to put Eugene Debs behind bars. And it was used particularly for people who seemed to be, like, bolstering the work of America's adversaries. Or that is how the U.S. government viewed, and I don't think it's a particularly good law to have on the books, but I can also say that fast forward to today and the way that it's used so regularly to punish federal government officials who release information to the press, that was never what was intended. And so this law has metastasized and is used in such an ugly manner. And I mean, couple that with the way in which Trump is governing, it really would be a good thing if, and you could say this for tons of issues, but I'll say this in particular for this, it would really be good if liberals, you know, like Rachel Maddow, Chris Hayes, go on down the line of all these people who have the ability in the press to get their commentary out to people. It'd be really great if they were sounding alarms about this as a power that Donald Trump has, because I do think that it can do a lot of damage.
Yeah, totally.
Anyways.
Sorry, yeah. I was just thinking if we should also talk about the Muslim ban, by the way.
Oh, no, I think we definitely should talk about the Muslim ban.
I know we had kind of come up with a list of things we wanted to talk about before, but now that we mentioned it, I feel like we should at least address the fact that of what happened with the Supreme Court decision, which basically said that this travel ban, which affects mostly Muslim majority nations, is constitutional and can stand. And the country most fucked by this is Iran. But I also want to note that, like, Yemen is on this list of countries where people are banned basically from traveling to the U.S. now. And it's a country where America is currently helping the Gulf states starve the people of that country. They've caused a famine, and they're also just bombing people relentlessly. It's just so fucked up. And then also, of course, Syria, which the U.S. helped fuck up. And then Somalia, which the U.S. has historically helped fuck up. But most important, I mean, most affected is going to be Iran. And I mean, what's happening to Iran now is really fucked up, because this is also happening at the same time that the U.S. has, you know, under Trump, is promising, is basically like in reinstituting the harshest sanctions possible, and is now also demanding that any country that imports oil from Iran must stop immediately. Or stop by November, I think, when sanctions go back into effect. Basically, they're destroying Iran's economy. It's having a really, really harsh impact on Iran. And no one seems to really notice that or care. So, like, the same people that you just mentioned, I wish would care about this, because it's really, like, really fucking over average Iranians. U.S. sanctions are, whether it's Trump doing them or a Democrat doing them, are really, really like tough and harsh and isolate countries and do a lot of damage to their economies and really, really hurt average people. And sometimes it's really difficult to just like convey how rough sanctions can be for a country because they don't sound sexy. They're just like financial instruments that sound really boring. But it's basically it's an act of economic warfare. I don't know how enticing I can make it sound, but like, it's really, really fucked up. And Iranians are going to hurt. And then now what's even more fucked up too is like, there's like these protests that have taken place in Iran. I think there was like a strike of truck workers or something along those lines. And they're angry about the state of the economy. And so the U.S. State Department is using that to basically be like, see, Iran's a terrible country. Look how bad its regime is. Look how terrible they are about their economy. But like, the U.S. caused the problem. So, but no one seems to care. Again, it's like no one's interested in issues of war and peace under Trump. Only domestic issues. So,
but well, also, that sounds really cynical. What caught my attention with the Muslim ban, all of what you said is excellent. What caught my attention is the fact that the Supreme Court noticed that the justices who were dissenting had invoked korematsu. And if you don't know off the top of your head what this is, Rania, this was the decision that the U.S. government that basically gave the U.S. government the authority to put Japanese Americans in internment camps.
Yeah.
During World War II. And so yeah. I think it was a bit of a hard pill to swallow for civil liberties organizations and other human rights groups in the U.S. that on the day that the Supreme Court issued this, they issued what a few people viewed as maybe the first unambiguous rejection or even like overturning of this decision from you know, way back to 1944, and said that the dissent's reference to korematsu affords the court the opportunity to make express what is already obvious. Korematsu was gravely wrong the day it was decided, has been overruled in the court of history, and to be clear, has no place in law under the Constitution. And I find it really hard and absurd to grapple with because it doesn't really make sense that you can do this to people and kind of like dehumanize them and keep them out of this country, but then at the same time admit that like, it was wrong historically 65 or 75 yeah. years ago to put people in camps when like the policy that we're talking about here with blocking people from coming to the country is the exact kind of thing that can be a precursor to that sort of policy.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's like really dangerous times that we live in, but I want to kind of like move into talking about something a little more positive, if that's okay.
Great.
'Cause I'm getting really pissed off, which is the fact that, okay, we don't usually talk happily or positively about much on this show, so this is going to be a first. But oh my God, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who was running for the 14th Congressional District in New York City, won against 10-term incumbent. What's his first name? His last name's Crowley. Is it?
It was Joe.
Crowley.
Joe Crowley.
Joe Crowley. I like that I got it wrong. It just shows how unimportant he is now. But it was like a complete like shock win. Obviously she's been in the news a lot lately in progressive media and some local New York media because she had this really great viral campaign ad. She's only 28 years old. This girl's only 28 years old. She worked on the Bernie Sanders campaign as like an activist. She's been an activist. A year ago she was a bartender. And like now she's going to be, I mean, she's like, it's New York City. So like, she's not going to lose her campaign. She's going to go to Congress and be representing that district in Congress. That's a big deal. And the Democrats, the establishment Democrats are of course already pissed. Nancy Pelosi, who was going to appoint, they all expected Joe Crowley to win. I mean, this guy was so sure he was going to win that he didn't even show up to two out of the three debates that he he was scheduled to have with Alexandria. He just didn't show up. In one case, I think he sent someone else to go debate her for him. He was so positive he was going to win. All the Democrats were so positive he was going to win. He was expected to be appointed as the next Speaker of the House for the Democrats, because Nancy Pelosi was expected to, I guess, step down from that position. Or was it House Minority Leader? Was it Speaker of the House?
Well, the Democrats would have to take the House first for that to happen.
Yeah, but I think are they planning to? Because I kept seeing them saying he was a possible contender because Nancy Pelosi, if Democrats were to win a majority, would be Speaker of the House.
I believe you. I haven't seen that, so it's hard for me. It's hard for me to let you know if that's correct. But for the purpose of this episode, that could be the correct.
All right, works for me. Either way, this guy was basically rising in the ranks of the Democratic Party, and it's really, really shocking that he lost. He didn't just lose; he lost. I believe it was 57. She won 57 or 58% of the vote. Anyways, it's really, really exciting and inspiring because she ran on a platform of, you know, Medicare for all. And she's in New fucking York City, okay? And she condemned the Israeli massacre of Palestinians in Gaza pretty explicitly. And then she stood by it, which I think shows you that, this sort of, Bernie Sanders populist left base in the Democratic Party really is the future of this party in many ways, hopefully. And that, in a place like New York City, you can win on a progressive platform, even being honest about Israel-Palestine. That's really incredible to see happen. And, you know, she's also big on all the shit that we agree with, all the shit that Bernie ran on.
I have her platform right here.
Yeah, go ahead. Go through it. Really left.
So this was the viral, I think it was actually Jeff Stein, who is now with Washington Post.
Washington Post?
Yeah. And this went everywhere. So if it sounds familiar to you, you did probably see it. It got 30,000 likes. And it was out there. Let people know, I think this was a handout flyer, let people know on June 26th, the day of the primary, that Ocasio was for Medicare for All, medicine, vision, mm-hmm. dental, to cover medicine, vision, dental, and mental health care, universal jobs guarantee to serve our communities with living wages, fully funded public schools and universities, plus taxing Wall Street to support tuition-free public university and trade schools, paid family and sick leave, giving everyone the right to choose care, housing as a human right, safe, secure, habitable, and affordable homes, justice system reform, end the war on drugs, demilitarized police, and abolish for-profit incarceration, immigration justice, protect Dreamers and TPS recipients, simplify the paths to citizenship, and, importantly, Rania, abolish ICE.
Mm-hmm. That's a big one.
Infrastructural overhaul, invest in 100% renewable green industry, clean campaign finance, end the corrupting influence of corporate finance in public elections, and then economy of peace, support our vets, and actively value humanity. So,
I mean, that's more left than Bernie Sanders' platform, yeah. Actually. I don't think he had a universal jobs program. I mean, maybe he had suggested that, but I don't think that was a part of his platform. Either way, she won on that fucking platform, and it shows that is what working class people can react, can respond to in a positive way. And that's the kind of vision that an opposition party that Democrats should have. And the other great thing about her, she didn't take corporate donations, and she made that, she repeatedly used that as one of her sort of selling points. And it was based all on small donations. Her whole campaign ran on small donations. She was endorsed by DSA. This, I think, is part of what we're going to see as a pattern where, you know, you've got these sort of new, younger people of the sort of Bernie Styles, you know, Bernie Sanders style platform running to the left of the Democratic Party in these Democratic primaries in districts where Democrats would win regardless, so that they can't, you can't, you know, in districts in New York City, you cannot accuse someone like her or others like her of being spoilers, you know, like you're going to, oh, no, you're going to lose the seat to a Republican because this is a seat that's going to go to a Democrat. So it's a seat that's worth like running against shitty establishment centrist Democrats to begin with. But it's just so inspiring. Like it made me feel so good to see that she won. And it really does like show you that like maybe there is a way to like push to push to the left. Like maybe there really is. I don't know. Also, Ben Jealous, the former head of the NAACP, who was a big Bernie Sanders surrogate in 2016, won the Democratic primary for governor of Maryland, which basically means he's going to be the next governor because Maryland governor is always a Democrat. So that's a big deal, too. Maryland is pretty much already a more progressive place, but he's even more left. And he was attacked, I believe, heavily by the Democratic establishment when he was running. So that was another upset, perhaps even a bigger upset for the Democrats than a congressional district in New York, because this is a whole state. But I think you're going to see more of this happening, and I'm so excited about it. But I do want to note, like, that not everybody is so happy about this, including the reaction from Nancy Pelosi, which I just absolutely loved. Basically, like, you know, Alexandria is a self-identified Democratic socialist, right? And so Nancy Pelosi was asked if, like, was asked about the S word, about socialism, and if it's ascendant, democratic socialism, if it's ascendant in the Democratic Party. And she responded with, she goes, with a firm no. She said, no, they're not. It's ascendant in that district, perhaps, but I don't accept any characterization of our party presented by the Republicans. So let me reject that right now. So she was very, very, very upset about that. But I just like love how, like, are you living in like the 90s still, really? Also, I know that, of course, like socialism is a scary word for corporate Democrats because they represent corporate interests, because that's who they take money from. However, at the same time, like the idea that we can't use the word socialism because the Republicans will attack us, like that doesn't work anymore. Like Bernie Sanders did so well among, even among people like that were Republican voters, like liked Bernie Sanders because of the vision he was offering. So the S word didn't bother them. Like, and it's just like funny that this is still the same bullshit excuse you hear from like the Democratic establishment. I imagine the attacks are going to become nastier moving forward. I think that the Democrats were really surprised. And like the Neera Tandons, the sort of Hillary movement of the party, is going to come back on the attack against people, against these sort of like left populist types. But I think what this demonstrates is that just because they beat Bernie Sanders doesn't mean they killed the momentum that was behind him.
Oh, absolutely. And speaking of Neera, I have this email that we got thanks to WikiLeaks. From her, it was about Ben Jealous. I don't know if you remember this statement that
yes,
Neera made.
I saw this.
I know. There are a million reasons to desperately want Hillary to win, but Ben Jealous feeling that he has no power is a particularly good one.
So that's been being passed around the internet since Ben Jealous won the nomination in Maryland, which is awesome. I just love, like, God.
Well, so, and then the other thing was, there are dozens of op-eds, editorials that were published in the last couple weeks that basically pronounced everything we're talking about here as being dead, that this Sanders, momentum, whether we're talking about Our Revolution or the People's Action or any of these groups that have been funding and working to support and promote candidates at all levels of government with democratic socialist policies or just very highly progressive platforms as part of their campaigns, they pronounced that this was just dead, that like it's, and you know, you have to laugh because basically a few days before Ocasio won this primary, they had this big story in the New York Times, and the headline, Rania, was Bernie Sanders is winning converts, but primary victories remain elusive.
They may have waited until the primaries in some of these cases were finished. That's awesome.
And it's like they were trying to depress turnout among voters. It's like the New York Times is deliberately trying to keep progressives or socialists or anybody, tell them to stay home. Don't even try to support these people. They can't win. And also, it's better for us if we put this out there as the message, because it's the only thing we have to try and protect corporate Democrats from losing.
Yeah, it's like, I mean, clearly, like, again, the New York Times is as establishment as it gets. So you're not going to have them cheering on these left populists, or actually, anybody really to the left of the Democratic Party.
Jim Narakis has done, like, really good work at FAIR, just documenting how this goes all the way back to the early 1900s, and the New York Times has always been this gatekeeper publication for the Democratic Party to control and manage, you know, socialists and also keep communists out. And any sort of leftist thinking has always been something that they do their best to outcast, to turn anybody who's like that into outcasts. And the paper has, I mean, it's, you know, the New York Times may be all the news that's fit to print, and that may be their slogan, but they could easily have one that involved policing the left, because that's basically what they've done throughout its entire history. So they've always been a gatekeeper publication, and it seems to be failing. I mean, people, I think that not only can you say that this is the future of the Democratic Party, but you can also say it's the future of the country, because I believe, and this is why, like, I haven't become completely cynical, is that even as I watch all of the accumulation and amassing of power within the Trump administration, I still don't see what they're doing as having any long-lasting impact on the country. That I just see, like, the political trends are so deep and so entrenched in the population that eventually everything that they've done is going to unravel in the next.
Well, it depends. I think it depends on how Democrats respond. And so far, the response has been shitty. So far, the response has been to obsess over Russia, which is something voters don't care about, and to kind of ignore what actual working people care about, and to sort of cede ground to hate, and to be a really shitty opposition party. By focusing on what I think are the wrong things and ignoring the things that actually matter in people's lives. And if Democrats continue to do that, we might actually get a reelected Trump. However, if Democrats, Democrats are their own, they're their own biggest obstacle, you know? If they allow people like Alexandria and people who have her vision, people who have Bernie Sanders' vision, if they allow them to flourish, then I think that Donald Trump can be easily beaten. And I think that all of this can be undone. But it really depends on if he gets a second term. If he gets a second term, then you've got 8 years, and there's things that are just going to be cemented into place that are going to be really, really difficult to undo later on. Like, he's just going to be able to do so much more damage. I think that he's going to be able to start, like, go ahead.
No, I'd say the only pushback that I'd give to that, because I think it's an interesting thing, is that if Trump does win, that does create issues, but I'm willing to argue that even if he was in office 8 years, that doesn't mean that any of what the GOP has done is actually going to be cemented, because there's just so much revulsion to everything that this administration is doing. I mean, they are actively turning people into hardcore progressives, if not socialists, by way in which they are governing, which I think is what frightens people who claim to be moderates or centrists the most, because they know that the reaction to this extremism is going to be an opposite reaction from the left that tugs us in, like, an even greater direction. But my hope is that when we would get that tug in the opposite direction, let's say 12 to 16 years from now, I'm really being long-term here, because I don't know that this happens fully in the next 4 to 8 years. I think that, like, what we're doing right now is we're building something that is going to pay a lot of benefits in the next 15 or 20 years. And I know it's terrible, like, liberals would probably get upset at me. They'd be like, oh yeah, but there are people now. There are immigrants who are being deported, Kevin. There are people who are getting thrown out of their homes. There are black people who are facing racism, and that's all true. But like in the short term, it's very hard because of what the Democrats have done. It's very hard for them to handle the fact that they're powerless. And we'll get to some of what I'm talking about specifically in a moment, because it involves Anthony Kennedy resigning from the Supreme Court.
And that's
the news that has captivated everyone. But I think that like going forward 15 or 20 years, there's just so much generationally that I just don't see everything that you would tell me Trump stands for. I don't think that becomes a long lasting part of the country. Or I believe that it's so much a part of the fabric of the history of the United States that people are seeing Donald Trump throw it and fling it in their faces. And they're like, oh, that's so ugly. We really do need to be better. Like, we can't have that kind of systematic oppression anymore.
Yeah, no, I think you make a really good point. I think this is a good point to actually segue to Anthony Kennedy.
Yeah, so this is probably what every single pundit is putting on their suit jackets and slacks and excited to go on TV and talk about this weekend. Nobody in news. It's Christmas. It's Christmas for journalists because they get to talk about approving and nominating the next Supreme Court nominee. So they're excited. Meanwhile, liberals are panicked. If you look online, it looks like the apocalypse is coming because they're going to nominate a conservative justice to the Supreme Court. And if it sounds like I'm mocking them or sort of like belittling them, it's because I'm not so sure that the impact that's going to happen is as severe as liberals are leading us on to believe. And also, I kind of resent the way in which they're expressing their discontent because it's coming out as this, maybe it was directed to you. I know that you've gotten a lot of flack before, but it's all like yesterday, everyone was going on about Hillary Clinton and blasting and attacking anybody who ever dissented against her during her 2016 campaign and blaming them and saying the reason why we're in this situation. Invoking Jill Stein and all these people who always, anytime there should be responsibility taken by people who actually have power, they want to shift it.
They blame us.
They want to shift it to them.
They blame us.
And they're attacking voters. I mean, okay, again, like voters, people who vote for third party, they don't have power. That's why we're not winning elections. Like,
well, also, if you wanted to get them on your side, maybe you don't. I don't think attacking them is the best way to go about that. Also, what bothers me too is like Democrats had the opportunity historically to prevent a lot of the conservative judges, a lot of the nominations of these conservative judges that are on the bench now, and they didn't. They could have filibustered, according to this one graphic. They could have filibustered Alito, Roberts, Thomas, and Scalia from getting into the Supreme Court. And with filibusters, they could have done that, and they didn't. Meanwhile, Republicans block any Supreme Court justice that Democrats put forth. And so Democrats always end up putting forth these, like, really shitty justices, except every so often you get, like, one really liberal one, like Sotomayor. But for the most part, they end up picking these, like, centrist or even, like, kind of center-right people, like Obama picked before he was out of office. And so it's like, God, you're such a shitty opposition party. And then now they really have no power, but like they just blame, you're right. Like that history attached to like the way they behave when they have no power is extremely infuriating.
And Kennedy is a conservative justice. He's a conservative vote. People go on and on about how he's a supposed liberal swing vote and can swing decisions. But His record, Rania, is not the most amazing thing to celebrate. In fact, in the last week here, he joined with every he was part of the five that supported the Muslim ban. He was part of the group of justices that backed the Janus ruling, which involved public sector unions and the idea that you can't force members to pay into the union in order to ensure that there are funds to manage and keep the union at working and functioning in a way that can consolidate power. So he's attacking public sector unions, joining conservatives and attacking public sector unions. I know that there's a big emphasis on how he backed same-sex marriage with the ruling. I would think it was the fact that he was involved in doing this when Obama was president. However, everyone goes on about how this is going to mean Roe v. Wade is overturned, and Anthony Kennedy wasn't a like a pro-abortion or pro-choice Supreme Court justice. In fact, he was back in the 90s or sorry, in 2000s, he there was a lawsuit against Dr. Leroy Carhart, who is an abortion doctor, physician, and he upheld this partial birth abortion ban that reproductive rights advocates said was going to make it harder to have access
Evan.
to abortion. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can now. Sorry about that.
He upheld this ban that reproductive rights advocates said was going to make it harder for women to access abortion. There's other things like he apparently authored this decision that made it so Miranda rights were actually weaker. I don't know
Oh.
if you know this. He
No.
was part of a decision. I think he even authored it that made it so you could go undercover inside prisons. And you can essentially entrap defendants into crimes.
Lovely guy.
And also, he was part of authoring the decision that says you could strip search any inmates that are coming into facilities. It doesn't matter. You don't have to have suspicion. You don't ha have to. You wouldn't do it based on the fact that they have like a violent background or a history in a particular crime. You can just strip search all inmates that come into prison facilities, and so I guess what I'm saying is, yeah, so he valued this reputation of being a kind of like swing vote or somebody who was centrist, so to speak, the kind of thing that really op appeals to Obama. He was put on the court by Ronald Reagan, but at the same time, I don't know that losing him represents that huge of a shift yet.
Shift.
And we have to wait to
It
see.
will if he replace. I guess if he replaces two, because like, is it Ginsburg the other one who's expected to like step down
If
next? So like if that were to happen, then that would definitely change the that would definitely shift the dynamics of the court and make it far more conservative. However, we're not there yet.
but it's a
This is basically.
conservative But it's a conservative court, and already, and
Yeah.
we had a panic. We had this panic. So, what I'm saying is, we had this panic when Roberts was nominated by George W. Bush. We had this panic when Samuel Alito was put on the court, and we've had troubling decisions since then. But we've also seen that what happens is Kagan or Sotomayor, and those were the justices that Obama put on the bench. That's that these people sometimes go along with these decisions that don't actually end up being that great for our country. And also we know, like you said, that the Democrats haven't really done a whole lot to stop earlier nominees. But I'm also saying that, like, we've seen a shift in the direction of the Supreme Court towards more conservative justices, but that doesn't necessarily mean that like we're going to lose our ability to challenge injustices and shift the politics. I mean, I think that like as much as like they're going to be super conservative, I think that like that doesn't mean that anybody should give up the fact that the way the country is turning is completely opposite of these nine people that are going to have this tremendous power on the Supreme Court.
Yeah, but I guess what I will say though is if he does get to appoint a second person, that would actually change the dynamic, and we would be fucked. The Supreme Court does have a lot of power. Like, even if the country believes one thing, the Supreme Court has a lot of power.
But in a scenario that could be very good is usually the Supreme Court has turned to Congress and said, like, you know, okay, we're ruling in this way. If you want to correct this, you could do a legislative change, but...
Well, yeah, there are ways around it, but, like, that's not exactly what ends up happening. Like, the Supreme Court... The point is, like, it is scary that if Trump gets to appoint a second person, and, I mean, I don't know, I see what you're saying, but I tend to take a little bit more of, like, an alarmist view on the Supreme Court thing. And I do think if he gets to appoint a second person to replace someone like Ginsburg, that would be really, really bad, because you'll have like a fully conservative Supreme Court. That can be disastrous more than it already is. That said, like, you know, obviously, yes, it's not the end of the world, but it's really bad. But I think that's kind of like, I don't think it's fair to do what the Democrats are doing or what their like supporters are doing, which is to like blame voters and just like yell at all the wrong people. And, like, throw a hissy fit.
I admit it's terrible. I suppose what I'm suggesting is that, like, they are going to end up trapped by the politics of a country that do not reflect their own beliefs, I think.
Yeah, but does it matter? I mean, that's like the case on a number of issues already. Like,
well,
like,
so, like, there were all, there you know, I mentioned the one partial birth abortion ban, as it was called in the 2000s. But earlier in the 90s, there was something more along the lines of what reproductive rights advocates wanted. There was a ruling from Anthony Kennedy, and he in that case he was a swing vote, and the only reason he changed was because he was sort of like sensing where the attitude of the country was. So there can be a politics at play here in the way justices choose to make certain decisions. So it's interesting because people who we viewed as super conservative, like Roberts, they actually end up being more liberal compared to who Donald Trump is picking. So do they start to change? Do they become people who vote with – does he become someone who would vote with Kagan and Sotomayor and Ginsburg? I guess what I'm trying to say is that, like, I don't want people to panic and feel powerless, because I just don't think that – I just think there's a lot that, like, can still happen, and I don't believe people should concede – that Donald Trump, even if he is packing the court with all these people, I don't know that we should concede that all of these cases that he's going to rule are going to actually be law that can be upheld. Like, I mean, it depends on what this court says, but I just feel like a lot of this stuff, again, it's a long-term thing, but 10 to 15 years from now, how much of these bad rulings could be overturned just on the basis that the Supreme Court was making bad law under Trump? Because we are in a political moment, and there was bad law. Like, there was bad law that has been made under when World War II was happening. There's been bad law. You know, the Dred Scott decision was bad law, and the Supreme Court is not always correct. And like, you know, as we react to rulings, we know that they're making bad decisions, and the only thing that corrects those decisions and makes them, because the Supreme Court, you know, they used to enforce laws against gay and lesbian people. You know, they had anti-sodomy laws that were used to make it impossible for gay and lesbian people to have relationships, and they enforced that, and it was crude and vile. And then now it's actually been turned completely around and in favor of not doing that kind of thing and taking those sorts of laws off the books. And so I just think that, like, there's a shift that's going on generationally. We recognize it with Bernie Sanders and all of these politicians that are running for office. And it's also reflected in the way in which most people in our generation want to go out to these people who are from the Trump administration and confront them in public. And the other thing we wanted to get to before we wrap the show is just to mention how the Democrats are basically, again, proving how feeble and not an opposition party they are by going after everyone and saying that they should not confront people in public because it's going to cost us votes in the 2018 midterms, which is a load of bullshit.
Well, exactly.
And you saw the past week, Maxine Waters was one of the very, very few Democratic representatives who said, you know, no, I think when they go out in public, we should make life difficult for them. And again, I don't think that should be something that's contested. If you are going to round up migrant children and potentially house thousands of them on military base camps or put them into private detention facilities or hold them in big box stores that are converted into prisons, then absolutely these people shouldn't be able to go anywhere and have a like peace and quiet to eat.
I just think it's so outrageous that people in the Democratic Party, the opposition party, would be calling it harassment to be kicking like Sarah Huckabee Sanders out of a restaurant, or I guess to be protesting people like the Department of Homeland Security secretary when she was eating at a Mexican restaurant of all places, as she's participating in the demonization of immigrants and the separation of the children from their parents at the border. I think it's incredibly important that people engage in these kinds of acts of civil disobedience against people in power who are behaving in a fascist manner, in an authoritarian manner, that in a racist manner that absolutely needs to be protested. And the fact that you have people like Chuck Schumer calling it harassment is just so infuriating. Like, what is your purpose as a party if you're not going to be an opposition party? What is your purpose? Is that all they do is like, it's like pretend resistance. Because you're sitting there, lecturing and like denouncing people who are protesting the party that you're supposed to be against, the people in the party who are committing these heinous acts like separating families. Instead of what you should be doing is applauding those people. I mean, it's just so. It's just like this is what I hate about the Democratic Party.
It's culture war. And Trump knows exactly that these officials are going to Mexican restaurants because they know that liberals are going to get upset and angry. And so they're going to continue to go to these places as they're doing what they're doing to deport immigrants. And they want us to get upset. And they want nothing more than for Democrats to get into this divisive argument over how much protest is acceptable, because it's going to distract and it's going to make it harder for us to build resistance to Donald Trump. I mean, I think he loves this sort of shit. But the fact is that, like, if we're going to react to what Donald Trump is doing, we need an equal and opposite and greater reaction to this sort of repulsive policies. Otherwise, we don't have a way of challenging what's happening. And, you know, that's being said with the reality that we have no control over all three branches of government. So all we have left is dissenting in the streets and in public and in restaurants and creating havoc in the media so that we make it uncomfortable and difficult for them to govern. That's all we have. I don't know, like, Democrats, like, wake up, go look at the way things are. and maybe like go read your history, like go look at how protesters had tactics, radical tactics in the 1960s and 70s. Like those are the tactics you have to adopt now to build power, because you were such a shitty party. You lost so many seats at all levels of government throughout the United States. And, you know, now you're left in this situation where you have to do what we do when we have no power to change your mind.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I just don't know what else to say other than ever. It's just really outrageous.
And, oh, there was one thing I wanted to work in here, and then I promise you we'll end the show. It really struck me. So, like, the Washington Post wrote an editorial about how we should let them eat in peace. And by the way, I saw that it was going around that Leni Riefenstahl, who was a propagandist for the Nazis, she herself had a similar protest like Sarah Huckabee Sanders that was covered back in the early 1900s when Hitler's Germany was in power. And she was upset that she got tossed or protested when she was at a restaurant out on the West Coast in the United States. And so, that should help you figure out like what side we're on and what side you should be on with this discussion here. But the Post published this paragraph and argued that Ms. Huckabee, Nielsen, and Stephen Miller should be allowed to eat dinner in peace. Those who are insisting that we are in a special moment justifying incivility should think for a moment how many Americans might find their own special moment. How hard is it to imagine, for example, people who strongly believe that abortion is murder deciding that judges or other officials who protect abortion rights should not be able to live peaceably with their families? To which the reason why I'm reading this is I have to tell the Washington Post, fuck you, that's already happened, it's a thing, judges have been... they've faced death threats. There are doctors who have been shot and killed, like George Tiller. He was murdered. And there are people out there who do this. The difference between them and us is that abortion does not function or rest upon actual sound science. It involves like religious delusional myths, and it perverts any understanding of how the human body actually works. And it takes all kinds of power from any person to decide what they want to do with their children and when they want to actually have a child. And it puts all the power in the hands of the government. And at the same time, you know, if you look at us, it's like we're talking about children who are massively being rounded up and ripped from their parents, which is a real and actual issue. It's an actual thing that is going on, and it deserves the sort of reaction that is being seen.
Absolutely. Like, I'm so sick of these disingenuous arguments. On that note, I can't anymore. Sorry. I'm out.
Rania can't even, which is...
I can't even. I always have something to say.
Which is the sign that we're done. Oh, do you have a minute? Because we should just acknowledge that people gave you some tips about flying
in the
air.
Yes, I do. Yes.
Flying in the air.
I do, yeah.
We appreciate these tips.
I have to fly in a few days, and I'm already getting nervous.
And let's see. I believe it was, one person said that they were concerned about you, and just wanted to make sure that as Hordium said, something or other is going to get you someday. Worry about stuff over which you have control. To all our benefit, you take a lot of personal and professional risk. Maybe this is displacement. Do like everyone else and see a therapist if you are able.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Like, I don't know if it requires that. And also, I don't have money for a therapist. They're expensive. But I appreciate the suggestion.
You are all Rania's therapist. That's why we're...
Yeah, exactly. That's why I'm asking you.
That's why we're doing this. We don't want to spend the money on... I'm sorry if, like, that's your job and you think we're taking... you know, money away from you by starting a standard of using patrons as a group therapist.
Group therapy. No, but that's not a bad idea. And I do wonder if, and maybe in some cases, like, I'm just like having anxiety about something else and it's just like manifesting in fear of flying. I don't know. That could totally be the thing.
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
I will say, not to like reinforce your fear, but I guess that's probably what I'm going to end up doing by saying this. that I was coming back from Augusta, Georgia to Chicago, and we took off, and we're flying in the air, and I look to the left, and you can see like lightning and storms, and
oh, that's scary.
And that was a rather rocky ride. The thing that I'm concerned about, and I think it's going to get to a point, maybe as a customer, you should start doing this when you board the airplane, but I am getting to the point where I believe that climate change is getting so severe that there are going to be storms that pop up when the plane is in the air that we're not even anticipating.
Why are you telling me this? This is like completely unnecessary. This is evil. You're evil.
I just unraveled all the therapy.
Twitter trolls were right about you, Kevin. No, I'm sorry. Go ahead. You were making a decent point, actually.
You're right, though. I have nothing.
No, but like nothing to add.
No. I mean, I still trust that we're not going to take off. Unless, because like yesterday.
Well, I think if you're above a storm, you should be fine. It's just a matter of like flying through one that you probably shouldn't do.
There's still that. No, and I think like the good thing to bring you down and make sure that like you're not too panicked is that my flight from Augusta to Chicago was delayed because there was severe weather and the planes weren't flying. So as long as like we can say to each other that these pilots and services aren't going to try to fly through this unbearable shit that is just going to be turbulent and make us sick. Like, as long as they're going to do that, then we know that, like, I'd rather be delayed on the ground for a few hours than fly through that and have, like, a really traumatic experience. So as long as they're doing that for us, like, I think we could probably be a little bit less concerned.
Well, no, I mean, I don't think that's something to be that's actually not the biggest thing I'm concerned about. I'm more concerned about like mechanical failures, which either way, I do appreciate all the advice. I did receive a lot of feedback. I did a Facebook post on it. Cause I just like wanted, cause I don't know. It's like nice to know that like other people have the same fears or like maybe people have remedies that help them. So I do appreciate all the feedback I got, both privately and publicly.
If I may ask, was there anything particularly good and sound that you heard from people?
A lot of people suggested anti-anxiety medication, which I may at some point try if it like continues. Like a lot of people suggested taking Xanax, it like really helps. Other people suggested alcohol, which I've definitely had like a glass of wine or a glass of wine or two before a flight. But my only issue is like if I do have a flight, sometimes I can't be drinking because I have to do something once I get on the ground. Like I have to work or something.
How do you function on less sleep? Because I can definitely say that my early morning flight to Augusta, I had no care about turbulence because I only had like 4 hours of sleep.
Well, sleep, I mean, sometimes being extremely exhausted I might fall asleep for like 45 minutes or something, but I can't sleep long on a plane. Like even if I'm really, really tired, I just like am miserably like awake.
It just kind of made me mellow.
So I have to be super exhausted.
Because the lack of sleep numbed me to my anxiety.
Yeah, no, it doesn't really work the same for me unless I haven't slept in like 20, unless like I haven't slept in a really, really long time, which only happens if it's like a super long flight, like from the Middle East to the US or something. Then maybe I can get a couple hours of sleep eventually. But for the most part, even if I'm really, really tired, I can't get any sleep on planes.
All right.
So yeah, sucks to be me. Anyways, on that note, it's time to end the show. But thank you for the responses. And we'll try to be back next week.